Hello and welcome to the Political History of the United States, episode 5.5, Cincinnatus. Welcome back. Last time, we talked about the dangerous situation that surrounded the Continental Army in the winter and early spring of 1783. Now, I'm going to confess to all of you that I actually had a bit more to say about the army and the aftermath of Newburgh. However, that episode was already quickly approaching the longest episode in the entire show's history. Had I gotten everything out there that I wanted to say, it would have easily been the longest episode that I have ever done. So instead of letting things get too far out of control, I decided to split things up a bit and shift some of that information over to this episode. If that episode felt like it had a bit of an abrupt end, that is the reason why. With that, today we are going to be looking at two primary topics. I'm going to begin by picking up with the events following Newburgh, and looking at just how that had changed things, as well as the fate of the army in the aftermath of the conspiracy. The war was quickly winding down, and in the aftermath of Newburgh, the feelings were increasingly that it was time for the army to go home. If the point of the entire conspiracy at Newburgh had been to force the hand of the states by scaring them, then the events of Newburgh were at least marginally successful. So far as the officers were concerned, the commutation of their pensions was approved as a function of the concern born out of the events in Newburgh. Ephelet Dyer, the Connecticut delegate, whose change of heart had pushed the vote in favor of commutation, was open about the fact that the events of the past several weeks had forced him to change his mind. Those who were close to him claimed that the officers had extorted the vote right out of him. By the end of March, the main danger had largely passed, but it still did leave some big questions. The Continental Army had just threatened to ignore civil authority unless they got what they wanted. Now, I think that there is a fair question here to just how far things would have actually gone. There remains a good argument that, although the officers were deeply unhappy with the situation, John Armstrong stood as somebody more radical than the average officer. It does not really seem to be a given that the officers would have actually carried through on their threats and refused to either disband or fight. But the mere rumblings of such considerations were unnerving to say the very least. Quickly, following that dramatic moment in the Temple of Virtue, the preliminary peace agreement reached the United States. If the army was something to fear, which by April of 1783 many believed that it was, and the war was ending, the obvious question shifted to whether or not there was any continued necessity to have a standing army at all. Unsurprisingly, with everything that had happened, it should not come as that much of a surprise that with peace, the prospect of disbanding the Continental Army was sounding like a pretty good idea. This, of course, brings up another problem, though. Congress had agreed to commutation at the end of the war, which, yeah, that is great and all, but it is not as though Congress actually had that kind of cash available. The alternative option was not that much better. Keeping an army in the field that had just gotten uncomfortably close to disregarding the civil authority? That doesn't seem like a situation that you really want to have. The good news here for Congress is that Washington was able to walk the officers away from any kind of repeat of March. The wind really had gone out of the sails of the conspiracy from earlier in the year, and at this point all of the men were well aware that they were not going to be getting all of their money up front. Washington argued with Congress that they needed to provide the men with at least 3 months of full pay. You simply could not send the army home with nothing to show for their time. The officers, well aware of the fact that the money didn't really exist, made clear that they would be willing to accept 1 month of back pay, with an agreement to pay the other 2 months in short order. The men, likewise, were not being terribly picky about where the money was coming from, suggesting that the states take it out of the requisitions that they owed Congress. Robert Morris himself was completely burnt out from all of this, and had in fact announced that as of May 1st, he was going to be stepping down. The problem was that, despite his own wishes to be done with all of this, the United States was mired in a deep economic catastrophe. They could neither afford to maintain the army, nor could they pay the bills required to disband it. The credit of the United States was not simply bad. It was non-existent. The nation lacked anything close to the credit that would have been required to borrow the $750,000 that it would cost to send the army home, with the 3 months of pay that Washington was advocating for. Plus, let's not actually pretend that the states were going to foot the bill via requisitions. But, you know who did have good enough credit to secure such a loan? Well, that would be Mr. Robert Morris himself. Morris was set on resigning. It had been part of an ultimatum that he had issued earlier in the year in an attempt to force the hands of the states. Therefore, when Alexander Hamilton and James Madison found themselves pressuring Morris at the end of April, not only to reverse course, but to front the money to pay the army, it seems counterintuitive that he ever would have even entertained the idea. Morris biographer Charles Rapalai points out that in addition to understanding the serious dangers that came from stiffing the army, Morris had already issued a whole lot of notes directly attached to his own credit. If he were to leave office, those already risky notes became that much more risky. So, already deeply indebted, Morris agreed to stay in office, so long as it took to handle the issues with the army. He likewise demanded that everybody acknowledge that this was the final time that he would use his own personal credit to float the United States. He ordered 15,000 sheets of paper, with plans to issue the necessary $750,000 in notes to pay the army. There is something of a sense of irony to all of this. We talked about the French cutting off the Americans' back during the first episode this season, telling them that this is the final loan, and really, guys, we mean it this time, there is no more money coming. Morris, in that case, had worked busily on changing the minds of the French in an effort to extract every last cent out of that all-important line of credit. Now, with the French no longer floating the United States, so much of that weight had inadvertently fallen directly onto the shoulders of Morris himself. Whereas once it was the French telling Morris that they were done giving money, it was now Morris saying the exact same thing to Congress. If Morris had decided to play a dangerous game earlier in the year to force through a greater concentration of power in the federal government, using the army as a weapon to try and convince everybody of the gravity of the situation, it is impossible to conclude anything other than Morris had lost. On June 6th, the paper was delivered and Morris worked late into the night, signing over 6,000 notes. In that Morris biography, Robert Morris, Financier of the American Revolution, by Charles Rapalai, a book which I've leaned heavily on so far this season, he points out what a miserable task this was for Morris. He had made a gambit at reforming the American economy and he had lost. He really did want to resign by this point. He understood just how hamstrung he was, and he was ready to be done with it all. With so much of his personal fortune now tied into this, however, he had little choice but to stay the course, regardless of how miserable it all made him. Finally, as he signed those 6,000 notes, worth some $750,000, he surely understood that each one of those notes plunged him personally into that much greater peril. On May 26, the order that everybody had been both anxiously anticipating and low-key dreading came down. It was time to begin sending people home. Technically, people were being moved into something more akin to a reserve status, as the war was not officially over. More pressingly, it is worth considering that at the end of May 1783, despite the preliminary peace agreement, the British were still occupying New York City. However, in short order, the army was reduced from 10,000 men down to a far smaller force of 2,700. in order to prevent chaos from breaking out. Washington had ordered that the men march to pre-designated locations before breaking up and going their own way. This helped avoid the concern that too many men might be heading home together and having dangerous conversations along their journey. It is interesting to note that even as the army was being furloughed, the notes from Morris were not quite done yet. In an environment that was already rife with distrust, and now the Congress calling for a rapid demobilization, many of the officers balked at the idea that they were ever going to get their pay. Speculators quickly made their way into the American camp, happy to make deals with the spurned officers, buying their notes at steep discounts, despite warnings from Washington to avoid that exact thing. The officers were desperate to slow down the rate of the furloughs. Everybody seemingly understood that going home without getting paid dramatically increased the chances that they were never going to get paid at all. Washington, in this regard, went ahead and flexed his own power and agreed to making the furloughs temporary, at least for the time being. In at least one instance, a mutiny broke out in Pennsylvania when, on June 12th, men under the command of Major Lansdale learned that the troops from Maryland had received more money than them because Maryland itself had voted them funds. This enraged the men who were in nearby Lancaster, some 80 miles away from Philadelphia. For a subset of these men, some 80 to 100 soldiers, this was all too much, and they decided that it was time to demand their back pay. They marched on Philadelphia and proceeded to scare the hell out of Congress, who found themselves having to hole up inside the Pennsylvania State House. John Dickinson, who had all those years ago stood opposed alongside Robert Morris to the Declaration of Independence, now called on his old friend for advice on how to deal with the pending crisis. Dickinson, now the governor of Pennsylvania, was advised by Morris to call the militia and put down the uprising, something which Alexander Hamilton would echo in his own meeting with Dickinson shortly afterwards. Yet despite these and subsequent warnings about the danger to both the National Bank and the Congress, Dickinson failed to react. People kept telling him that it was time to call out the militia, that it was time to do something, anything really. Yet nothing came from the Pennsylvania governor. The problem was not necessarily that Dickinson was opposed to calling out the militia. Rather, he had it on good intelligence that if he were to call the militia out, that they were not planning on showing up. You see, the problem with the militia was twofold. The primary argument coming from the militia leadership is that nothing had actually happened. Sure, the men were marching around and being menacing, but they had not done anything else. The group had not even threatened the possibility of violence. Was being menacing a sufficient reason for the militia to come out and interfere? The militia answered with a resounding no. Secondary to all of this, of course, is the very real possibility that many of those in the militia that were to be called out were far more sympathetic to the plight of those mutineers as compared to those in the government denying their just day. Furthermore, Dickinson's reputation had never totally recovered following his stance on the Declaration back in 1776. He had only just barely won his election to the governorship, and calling out the militia was going to be an unpopular move amongst the citizens of Pennsylvania. His opponents in the Constitutionalist Party argued that any such attempt by the national government to intercede was an overreach of central powers. The question of the extent of national powers was a very significant concern for many during this period. This incident drew into question what police powers a central government should have. So, with fears of the militia refusing to respond and the political risk to himself personally, Dickinson declined to call out the militia. Dickinson biographer Milton Flower argues that, as compared to the proposed response by the likes of Hamilton and both Robert and Governor Morris, to call out the militia to crush the mutiny, Dickinson, true to himself, took the moderate position. Now, to be fair, this really is about as far as the Philadelphia Mutiny of 1783 went. It absolutely did spook Congress and did force Washington to send some 1,500 men in to put down the uprising. Although largely it was Dickinson himself, with an assist from Dr. Benjamin Rush, who were able to talk everybody down from the brink. Congress, no longer feeling secure inside of the city, was forced from Philadelphia to Princeton, New Jersey. Thus, although the situation never became particularly violent, it was enough to make everybody mighty uneasy. Although you did have that incident in Philadelphia, where some 80 or so disgruntled soldiers effectively chased Congress out of the city, that really was not the norm. Most of the soldiers did, in fact, head home empty-handed. This meant for many having to either beg for a handout or delay their journeys in order to get a job, in order to fund their trip back home. While the officers were busy worrying about preserving their hard-earned gentlemanly status, for many of the ordinary enlisted men, the end of the war meant having to figure out, on their own, how to get home without any money in their pockets. The disbanding of the army was anything but a smooth affair. In July, the officers did receive their commutations. For generals, this payment was as high as $10,000. The war was truly coming to an end. The men were paid and the army was quickly being broken apart. Yet, several critical questions still remained. Recall that so much of what had transpired at Newburgh was the result of Morris and that cadre of men in Congress trying to get the states on board with granting the national government more power, specifically the power to levy an impost on imports. If the entire ordeal at Newburgh, then, had been to scare the states into granting the national government more power, then Robert Morris and company were about to be very disappointed. On April 7th, Congress once again took up the question of revenue. Congress had settled on the need to collect $2.5 million per year in revenue just to service the debt. The plan was that $1.5 million of that would come from requisitions. That process of sending bills to the state and then crossing their fingers and hoping that the states felt generous enough, or realistically, that they had the ability to pay up. The remainder would come from an impost on imports. Now, of course, we know that the previous attempt at an impost had failed back in the fall of the previous year. Now, though, the hope was that with the army exhibiting the very real danger that came along with not paying your debts, maybe, just maybe, the states would feel differently about the impost this time. Spoiler alert, they did not. The proposed impost would have been on all imports of alcohol, tea, sugar, molasses, and coffee. It would have been a tariff of 5%, limited to a period not to exceed 25 years. The use of the funds was to be restricted to the retirement of war debt. More radical parts of the measure, such as Morris's desire to see the federal government assume the war debts, a topic that we are going to return to again in the future, did not even garner a debate. Interestingly, part of the debates here did fall on exactly how to proportion the money from the states. Now, this is something that we had actually talked about briefly back in episode 4.37. The smaller states wanted the more populous states to carry a bigger burden, whereas those larger states were happy with an equal requisitioning of funds. Ultimately, it was decided that the requisitions would indeed be population-based, which brings us back to that question of the slaves. In this context, the larger southern states were more than happy not to count the slaves, whereas the northern states felt otherwise. Eventually, the compromise that was reached, a compromise that would be engineered by James Madison, was that an enslaved person would count as 3/5 of a person for the population. We are going to spend a whole lot more time in the coming months talking about the 3/5 clause, but right here we see an early incarnation of it. Now, as far as the impost, I'm just going to go ahead and bury the lead on this one. It is never going to pass. We have talked extensively about the economy already, specifically back in episode 5.3. The most recent attempt to get the impost passed is going to fall short yet again, although it is going to take years to do so. 9 of the states got on board pretty much right away. Then, as is really the story of the Confederation period, everything ground to a halt. By 1786, New York and Georgia remained the only holdouts. However, in a system that required unanimity for an amendment, even a single state holding out was no small problem. Sure, attempts were made to bring New York into the fold. An anonymous petition entitled The Inhabitants of New York to the Legislature of New York was published in early 1786, encouraging the state assembly to pass the impost. They concluded the letter with the following. The government implies trust, and every government must be trusted so far as is necessary to enable it to attain the ends for which it was instituted, without which insult and opposition from abroad confusion and convulsions at home. Eventually, New York decided that they were going to go ahead and agree, just so long as a few concessions be granted. Now, if you are sitting there and wondering what those concessions were, well, I'm going to tell you. New York had, after years of debate and reluctance, agreed to the impost, so long as local authorities collect the money and remain answerable to the local courts. Second, they demanded that Congress make the impost payable in bills of credit from the state. This was simply more authority than Congress was willing to cede to a single state. By the end of 1786, the second attempt at an impost was just as dead as that first attempt. The impost was dead, and it was not going to be resurrected this time. We are going to talk more in a future episode about the fallout from the second failed impost, and spoiler alert, it is not going to be good. There are, however, a handful of things that we still need to cover before we tie a bow on this and move forward. However, for now, know that if the purpose of the Newburgh conspiracy in Congress had been to scare the states into compliance by letting them see the dangers of not paying their bills, well, in that regard, it was a failure. It took years to make the final decision. But during the Confederation era, there would never come a moment when the states would agree to grant the federal government any ability to directly tax. Likewise, in both the first and second fight over the impost, we see the power that a single dissenting state could carry. Unanimity meant unanimity. The impost was never rejected by the majority of the states. The opposite was in fact true. Most of the states supported granting Congress the power of the impost. However, in both instances, it was a small number of holdouts that would render the entire project impossible. This is, of course, going to have huge repercussions down the road. It is not a coincidence that the second impost officially died in 1786, and then a year later work would begin on reinventing the wheel in the form of the new Constitution. However, that is a story for a little bit further in our future. Throughout 1783, the War of American Independence was truly coming to an end. To wrap up for today, I want to tie up those final remaining loose ends. During that June, as the officers grumbled at the idea of being separated before getting paid, Henry Knox got the idea that it would be a good idea to form an association of the Continental Army officers, a way to keep them connected after the war and to keep those ties of brotherhood they had formed intact. The group was to be called the Society of the Cincinnati, named after the Roman politician and leader who declined absolute power in order to return to his farm and pick up his plow as a regular citizen. He stood as a symbol of civic virtue in Roman society, and for a populace that made sure to read their livy, the Americans were well acquainted with the stories. Although the overarching mission of the Society of the Cincinnati was to act as a fraternal organization to commemorate their accomplishments, it also acted as a short-term method to ensure that the officers would continue to hold a degree of political power, to make sure that their communications were not forgotten about in the shadow of a disbanding army. Now, this all sounds well and good. You are probably listening and thinking, okay, so they formed an organization where they can all get together and share war stories. No big deal, right? Well, hold that thought. First, let's talk about the structure of the group, which held its first meeting in Fishkill, New York on June 19, 1783. The Cincinnati was going to be a fraternal organization of officers only. Enlisted men were not welcome, Membership was automatically conferred on the officers and then would be hereditary from there, passing from firstborn son to firstborn son. And if you're curious, the society still does exist today. The first president of the society was, probably unsurprisingly, George Washington. Although we can argue that Knox probably founded the group, and Washington accepted the presidency of it with good intentions, it would end up looking more like a short-sighted decision. The war that these men had just fought was to create something new, unlike what existed back in the old world. We have talked about in the past the fact that the United States lacked an official aristocracy. There were no hereditary titles. This is something that people were very happy with for the large number of merchants and artisans inside the United States. They were perfectly happy not having an aristocracy. The entire idea, therefore, of what the officers were doing here offended both the civilian population as well as the enlisted men who, despite having sacrificed and fought in the same war, were left on the outside looking in. In time, Washington was going to come to deeply regret having anything to do with the society. People really were upset with the idea of the officers heading off and forming what people feared to be the basis of an American aristocracy. Mix in with that a healthy distrust for the existence of a standing army, and the Cincinnati quickly became a deeply unpopular organization. Among the critics of the society included Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Benjamin Franklin. Washington was completely blindsided by all of this. When he had agreed to serve as the president of the society, he just completely missed on how unpopular that was going to prove to be. He never read into the political concerns that would surround the society, and instead always just viewed it as a way for the officers to support themselves. To his credit, Washington got the hint pretty quickly, and would attempt to pivot during the society's 1784 convention. It was there, as their president, that he attempted to walk back some of the most repugnant parts of the Cincinnati, specifically calling for the abolishing of the requirement that the society be hereditary in nature. Although those assembled in Philadelphia would give a tacit agreement to Washington's suggestions, nobody really seemed terribly motivated to follow up on them. Understanding the position that being involved with the Cincinnati now put him in, Washington would spend the next several years trying to distance himself from the organization. He stopped wearing any of their symbols and generally stopped participating in anything related to the Cincinnati. Although, as historian John Fairling points out, that despite asking not to be re-elected, when the society went ahead and re-elected him anyway in 1787, Washington never actually resigned the position, and in fact would remain their president until his death in 1799. Another far more clear sign that the war was coming to an end throughout the summer months of 1783 came as Guy Carleton worked at pulling the British troops out of the still-occupied New York. Historian Woody Holton writes that the evacuation of New York was unique in that it was the one place where the fate of the slaves that had escaped across British lines largely did secure their freedom and escape. This is in stark contrast to the events in the South, where Cornwallis unceremoniously abandoned the escaped slaves to their fates. In 1783 New York, however, Carleton was not interested in helping the slaveholders, who came hoping to recover what they viewed to be their property. New York had long been George Washington's white whale. Ever since the city had been captured by Howe back in 1776, Washington had continued to view it as the linchpin of the entire war. There might have been a kernel of truth to that at one point. Had the British used their control over the Hudson more to their advantage, maybe they do pull off the isolation of New England. However, long after that threat had subsided, Washington remained fixated on the city. Even on the eve of the Battle of Yorktown, Washington only begrudgingly left New York at the urging of his French counterparts. In November, the British evacuation of New York was coming to an end. On the 25th, as the final British troops boarded their ships in the harbor, a triumphant Washington entered the city and paraded through it. It had been more than 7 years since he had evacuated the city. So much had changed since those terrible days in 1776. some of the darkest of the entire war. One can only imagine how Washington must have reflected on those losses. The outflanking on Long Island, the fleeing troops when Howe had landed on Manhattan, the debacle at Fort Washington. Yet, the Americans had survived it all. The British were leaving. The United States was now its own sovereign entity. Bad weather delayed Carleton's departure, leaving the British lingering off the coast. Something that was probably reminiscent of General Howe waiting for what seemed like an eternity off the coast back in 1776. This time, however, the British were not landing, but rather they were leaving. On December 4th, that is exactly what happened. The British were gone. New York was back in the hands of the United States. Washington would enjoy a lunch with his officers that day in the city, the final time he would do so. By this point, the only real thing on Washington's mind was home. He missed Mount Vernon. The war had taken an undeniable toll on the man, and after 8 long years, he was ready to head back to Mount Vernon and call it a day. Leaving New York with only a single aide at his side, David Humphreys, Washington set out to head back towards his Virginian home. Before he could do that, however, he still had a couple of loose ends that he needed to tie up. First, he did need to make sure that he got himself paid, stopping in Annapolis to drop off the bill with Congress. If you are wondering why the Congress was meeting in Annapolis, it came as a result of that mutiny in Philadelphia that we spoke about earlier today. The Congress would bounce around a lot over the coming years before finally landing back in Philadelphia in 1787 for the Constitutional Convention. Washington dropped off the bill, which per Washington biographer John Fairlane was calculated to be $1 short. Washington was paid a total of $64,355.30, including that extra dollar. A squaring of the books aside, there was far more important business to conduct in Annapolis. On December 23, 1783, Washington was set to appear before the Congress. This was no regular session. Rather, the man who had led the Continental Army through the war that had secured their independence was coming in to play the role of Cincinnatus. The war was over. The definitive peace signed. The British had left New York. Washington was prepared now, after 8 long years, to lay down his sword before returning to Mount Vernon to pick up that plow. For a nation trying to highlight its new republican virtue, this had to go off without a hitch. This ceremony, therefore, was not some spontaneous thing. It was anything but business as usual. Rather, this was a highly choreographed bit of theater. Washington entered the room, being announced by the President of Congress, Thomas Mifflin. He sat across from Mifflin before being given the floor. He rose, bowed to Congress, who critically did not bow back, and then stated, "I retire from the great theater of action, and bidding an affectionate farewell to this august body under whose orders I have so long acted, I here offer my commission and take my leave of all the employment of public life." Mifflin, accepting the resignation, read a prepared statement that was written by Thomas Jefferson. Mifflin told Washington in front of the assembled Congress, "You have conducted the great military contest with wisdom and fortitude, invariably regarding the rights of the civil power through all disasters and changes." The final nod to the civil power was something very likely influenced by the events at Newburgh earlier in the year. Events that had threatened that very power. Washington had, at all points in the war, remained very cognizant of that civil authority. He was always exceedingly careful not to overstep the bounds of his commission. Early on during the war, it was this deference to civil authority that at times seemed to tie him up, as he felt compelled to defer to his most senior officers. Although where this proved to be really the case was outside of Boston in 1775 and early 1776, where his officers, probably wisely, kept shooting Washington's ambitions down of taking the city by force. I think we can probably argue that was for the best. The war was well and truly over. The army had disbanded. The British had evacuated. Yet, the revolution itself did not feel over. The Confederation was an undeniable mess and was seemingly incapable of righting the course. When it falls to a private citizen to pay the army because the nation's credit is so poor, well, it does not take an economist to tell you that is not an ideal situation. As we know from today and from the previous episodes, the impost was dead and the National Bank, too, was not long for this world. Congress completely lacked the ability to raise funds itself and were instead left with a requisition process that was a little better than asking the states to pay by asking pretty please. Now, in the days after the end of the war, the revolution somehow seemed to be in grave danger. Next time, we are going to spend our time looking at the political developments going on in the United States during the Confederation. Although the economy was the backdrop of everything, the government was forced to deal with other problems as well, as not everybody was thrilled with the new peace. When we return, we are going to find out just what their complaints were, and how the government planned to deal with them. Until then, I hope you all have a wonderful 2 weeks. I hope that you are staying healthy and that you are staying safe. And I will see you back here next time as we continue looking at the failures of the Confederation.